What's cracking, folks? I'm Jared Dubin, and this is Quo Vadimus. We have the return of our regular Friday podcast discussing the Thursday night TNT games. This week we had Celtics-Bulls in the early game, and surprisingly, the better game of the night, Lakers-Kings. Didn't really get good until late, but it did get rather interesting down the stretch. Seth Partnow on the other line right now, editor of Nylon Calculus. What's up, man? How you been?
Happy 2016.
Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, Happy Hanukkah, everything.
Yeah, there we go. Festivus.
We've got all of the holiday wishes out of there now, so let's jump right in. Celtics-Bulls, what were your thoughts of this game?
So, the Celtics have been a team. Have we talked about the Celtics before on this? I don't remember.
Early in the season, I think we had one of their games, but we didn't go too in-depth, if I'm remembering correctly.
So, the Celtics are a team, like, every time I feel like I'm... Okay, so... little background, a lot of the writers at Nylon Calculus do win projections, and they all had the Celtics winning 49, 50, 51 games somewhere in there. And I was skeptical, and, you know, I've been going back and forth between, like, literally, like, writing the first two paragraphs of an article saying, here's what I missed about the Celtics, and here's why I was right about the Celtics.
Before you go into this point, though, can you just elaborate a little bit? Because I know that both you and Ian have written about it, Ian Levy, about, you know, why the projection systems were higher on the Celtics than most people seem to be.
So basically, it's, you know, you watch the Celtics and Isaiah Thomas aside, and you know, what you think of him aside, the Celtics don't have a lot of, you know, star-level players. What they do have is a rotation, especially now that David Lee has been kind of excised from it, that doesn't have any bad players. And so a lot of kind of projection systems and are valuing the fact that they aren't giving any minutes to quote-unquote negative players. And you know, it's easy to see why that is, but at the same time, the fact that they kind of lack at the top end is a bit why I'm skeptical. In addition, there's some kind of wonky metrics-based reasons why I think that some of their players may have been kind of individually over-projected in various rating systems, but that's kind of neither here nor there, but for those reasons, like if you had told me that you're projecting the Celtics to win, like, you know, 44 games, something like that, I would have been on board. When I started to see like 50 wins as kind of a median projection tossed around was when I got a little skeptical. And, you know, it's funny because when they're playing well, it's like, well, you see their defense and their depth, and they have just enough offense, and look how good they are. And then, you know, a stretch like now where they're playing badly, it's like, how are they ever going to score against a good team? And so you kind of are seeing, right now it's looking like I'm more right, but in 2 weeks they'll have won five in a row, and this kind of push and pull has been going on all season with them.
It is sort of, you know, the way you look at it, though, it is a team that sort of seems like it's stereotypically set up for regular season success, you know, because of the fact that they don't really have any bad players, and also because of the fact that not a lot of their players are definitively better than the other ones. So on any given night, you know, you can use any combination of those players that you want based on what the matchup presents. You know, now that can be a good thing in cases where you say like they're playing well and they find the right combination on a given night and everything works. But then, you know, because they don't have any, depending on your view of Isaiah, like you said, of those over-the-top good players, it could be a bad thing on any given night. Because if Stevens or, you know, last night Jay Larinaga was filling in, if they don't find that right matchup on any given night, then it could just look like they're throwing a bunch of average guys out there, and that's not usually enough to beat a team like Chicago or Cleveland or whoever.
Yeah, and actually, I mean, I know we're getting a little bit of a field from this game, but the disappointing thing is, from a Celtics standpoint, is their, you know, if you were a backer of them having a big record, you were thinking, all right, they're a team that's always going to take care of business with the, you know, the Lakers and the Nets of the world, and then maybe struggle against the top teams, but be in those games and win just enough of them. Well, they've kind of, you know, in this last little scuffling bit, who have they lost to? They lost to the Nets. They lost to the Lakers. You know, losing in Detroit is not shameful, but that's a, you know, if you are, you know, thinking that they are a 50-win team, that's a game you hope to win.
Right. If you have designs on being, say, like the 2 seed in the East, like people were talking about, what, like a week and a half ago, you don't lose those games. You know, they're also, you know, now even with those losses, they're 14-3 against teams below 500, and 5-14 against teams above 500. So
and also just kind of killing the teams after last night, they're either sixth or seventh in point differential. So, you know, which, you know, makes it look like their record should be, quote, better than it is. And again, those same things that we're talking about.
They have, I'm looking at it now, they have the fourth most double-digit wins in the league, tied with the Pacers and Raptors. You know, two more than Cleveland does.
Yeah, and so that's, you know, that you can either say, well, that their record should, if they keep playing that way, their record should improve because that'll normalize, or those same things we're talking about, you know, maybe put them at a deficit in kind of close games against good teams. Because, you know, getting back to the original point, how are they going to score down the stretch in those games?
Right. So, and anyway. You know, that problem presents itself, I think, a little bit with Isaiah just because he's so small. You know, if you load up on a guy like that and his drives down the stretch, you force him to take 20-footers over size. You know, that's a lot of what Cleveland did in that game. That was the game that we talked about, the Celtics versus the Cavs a few weeks ago, where we both said we liked the fact that they gave him a lot of size to work through, especially in the second half.
And I think we talked about that, and it's worth mentioning now that's, you know, I've done some work breaking down how players perform versus kind of starting lineups versus against bench lineups. And one of the guys with the kind of each of the last 2 years, one of the bigger efficiency splits where he just scores much more efficiently against the bench than he does against starters is Isaiah Thomas. And I think that indicates a little bit what you're talking about. Like you throw like starter quality size at him, and then make him the focal point of the offense. You know, he might struggle. He has, like, over the last 2 years, both in Boston and in Phoenix, struggled a little.
And that's, so, you know, during most of the game, Stevens can get him matched up. Or, you know, again, Larinaga last night, because Brad Stevens was visiting one of his former Butler players who has been dealing with, forget what kind of cancer.
Non-Hodgkin's
lymphoma, which, you know, very sad situation. So Stevens can get him matched up on those bench guys throughout most of the game, but when it comes down the stretch, you're always going to be playing against those starter quality guys unless the game is out of hand. And that, you know, I think feeds into what you're talking about with them not being able to score quite as well down the stretch.
But then, of course, you know, to contradict myself, on the other hand, you know, these two back-to-back losses, there's something like 11 of 53 from three. In two games that actually turned out to be reasonably close. So it's, you know, there's all the stuff we're talking about. Maybe, you know, and so even last night, like Thomas got, you know, not a lot of, I don't want to say easy threes, but a lot of moderately open threes, kind of off the dribble. And, you know, those aren't easy
or like
shots,
those,
but
those handoffs too. They run so many handoff pick and rolls with him.
Yeah.
I like it. You know, it gets some open shots.
But then those shots have got to go in, and if they don't go in, then where else do you go?
Yeah, they are in the last 5 minutes of games within 5 points, they are 29, 27, 25, 23rd in offensive efficiency. 98.3 points per 100 possessions. It's only in 66 minutes of game time, but that's basically the equivalent of, you know, a bottom five offense in the league over the course of a game.
Sure, and it wouldn't necessarily expect him to be that bad in kind of those crunch situations, but that being not a strength of this team, I think is predictable.
Right. But back to the actual game that we watched last night. What did you... So, the overriding thing for me about the second half was that it was honestly fucking boring as hell. Like...
the Bulls have a way of doing that still. Yeah, like, still. Even with...
And that was... somebody tweeted it after the game. I can't remember who. I think it might have been Casey Johnson from Chicago, but... that was the ninth game in a row they scored at least 100 points, which was the first time since 1995. And still, I was bored to tears during the second half of the game.
I don't know what it is. Just something about the way that the Bulls play.
It's like they just strangle possessions on both sides of the court.
Yeah. Like Jimmy Butler is great. He's rare, like, other than being really good, he's not always fun. And that's not a knock on him, it's just as a, you know, you put him together with kind of, you know, Derrick Rose doing the best of what we might expect to see of Derrick Rose, but it's still kind of bulldozer-y almost.
Right, they both sort of ugly up the game and just use sheer, like, physical force. Like, it's not pretty basketball to watch. It's just sort of overpowering.
Yeah. And, you know, then, you had Gasol and Gibson and, you know, Portis is a... It fits in very well, actually, just because of his kind of...
I am here for Bobby Portis. Like,
hey, you know...
I've been driving the bandwagon since before the draft.
No, the one issue is it seems like he's a little I don't want to.
He's shot happy.
Yeah, that's the one. That's where I was going to go with it. Yes, he it's going up if he gets it. He is making up for lost time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he didn't play a lot at the start of the year. It still doesn't. I mean, Hoiberg has said that they're going to try to get him more minutes, but you know, you look at all the guys they have in the front court. They're already shoehorning Mirotić to the three, which, you know, I can guarantee we'll talk about at some point during this podcast, in order to find minutes for Portis. He's still coming off the bench. You know, he's not necessarily a perfect fit with any of those front court guys that are there. So, you know, maybe he just feels like he needs to make his mark in order to stay in the rotation. Because, you know, even though he's outplayed somebody like Mirotić by a long shot... They seem to be more dedicated to him.
Mirotić in the last, I don't know, 10 days or so has started to pick it back up again.
He hit those two handoff threes last night from Pau, and they were deep threes.
I thought you were going to say from Palatine or something like that. Oh,
They were so deep, and Boston was just like, oh yeah, we're not going to guard him out there, and then he knocks them both down, like 28 footers or whatever. That was encouraging to see, because since basically the first couple games of the season, he hadn't been shooting well at all.
But again, it seems like in the last, I don't know, week, 10 days or so, he's been better in some part because he's kind of starting to do some of the other things more, get to the free throw line, get on the boards. Contribute in other areas. He had one game, I think it was last week, where he had 7 assists, if I remember correctly.
So yeah, that was against the Knicks. He had like 4 threes and 7 assists.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's 46% from the field, 42% from three in the last 5 games. But the 5th game of those... he was 0-for-2 from the field and 0-for-1 from 3. So in the last 4 games, he's 8-10-4-23 from 3.
So that's obviously sustainable for a career, about 34% three-point shooter.
Yeah.
but, yeah.
100%.
But him playing well, I mean, it's you know, it's not always pretty because he's kind of, you know, jacking up long threes and then driving into contact.
Yeah, and if he's not doing that, he's pump faking for absolutely no reason. Like he did that late in the first quarter. He got the ball directly under the basket, nobody near him, pump fakes for no reason, and then gets fouled on the way up and shoots two instead of getting an and-one.
Yeah. But I to finish up your point, I you know, this Bulls team still that same kind of that almost grit and grind North identity is still there, and you know, as much as Hoiberg was going to change everything, I mean, it's still the same players, and you know, that's these are a group of players who are, that is what they're going to produce, it seems like, at this point.
Right. And, you know, given, so Taj and Pau are both free agents this offseason. Or no, not Taj and Pau. Noah and Pau are both free agents this offseason. So given, you know, Taj is still on the roster, Portis looks like he's a good player. What do you think happens there with those two guys? I mean, I would imagine at least one of them is not long for Chicago.
The wonder is you know, and I'm sure you've talked about this before, and I know I have, is you know, who amongst their front court has trade value, and it's maybe Gibson. Yeah, I can't imagine that.
Right, but if you try to trade him, then all of a sudden you could wind up without all three of those guys next year.
Yeah, exactly. And so that puts them in a weird spot. And you know, I kind of floated the idea this summer that they should explore trading Noah. And I understand why, you know, you wouldn't, but it's trading him now would be very difficult, both, you know, for team reasons. And for the fact that he's bit hurt and expiring, and has been
it's not just that he's hurt now. You know, he's been hurt on and off for the better part of 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, he's kind of lingering effects of Thibs fever.
Right, and you know, now this is the fifth straight year that his field goal percentage has declined. 2010-11, he shot 52.5%. Then 50.8, 48.1, 47.5, 44.5, 40.7. You know, and that's obviously his less effective side of the ball. But not quite the same effect as a passer recently. You know, he's handles the ball a little bit more, obviously, than he did back then. But because guys don't feel like they have to guard him, I feel like his lanes aren't as clean. And he's got to throw stuff through the muck a lot more than he used to.
I agree with that completely. And also, it's a lot of his passing before was, you know, kind of hitting guys cutting and stuff like that. And with him, you know, having to play alongside another big, much more, you know, those lanes, that kind of Princeton style action just isn't available for them nearly as much as it was, you know, kind of in his heyday of you know, probably his best year was 2 years ago, I'd say.
Well, and there's also, you know, now another ball handler on the perimeter, which they didn't have as much. You know, the ball is in Butler's hands a lot more than it ever was in, you know, Korver or Ronnie Brewer or any of the other guys that played that spot before him.
And his playmaking, by the way, is it's worth time. I mean, he had 10 assists last night.
Yeah. And the last time we talked about a Bulls game, we both commented, I think, that we thought it was his best passing game we'd seen. Last night was even better.
Yeah, and he's up to, you know, 4 assists per game on the year, which, you know, it's not a perfect measure of ball, but still, that's a kind of a quantum improvement in his game. Whereas, you know, last year, kind of his scoring and usage, you know, bumped up, and some of that was just being healthy. But now this year, he's kind of added much more of a ability to kind of operate and create for others. And like I think we've both alluded to, it's not always pretty, but it works.
Right. And, you know, this is now the big trend for him throughout his career. Every single year, his assists per game, per 36, per 100 possessions, and as a percentage of team baskets have gone up every single season for him.
And it's just the continued improvement of his game. It's just, it's very unusual for a guy to just get this much better year on year consistently.
He had that dip 2 years ago with it, but it was almost all shooting related when he had that injury.
And he was hurt that year. I mean, he had the heel problem.
Right. That's what I was when he had the multiple injuries throughout that season and basically just couldn't shoot from anywhere. It wasn't just his deep shooting. He didn't finish as well either. You know, down at 59% inside 3 feet, where in his second year he was at 68%, last year he was at 62%, this year he's at 67%. So, you know, even his inside shots were not as good that year.
Right.
Right. So I do want to talk about, we've talked about Rose a few times on here about, you know, whether or not he'll ever get back to being a superstar player, blah, 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 stuff like that. Not going to touch on that now because I think we've done it a bunch. But it's always interesting to me how, you know, the first time Rose drives to the basket every game, no matter who's announcing the game, they're always like, see, that's what we like to see with Derrick Rose. He's got to attack the basket. He doesn't do that enough. But, like, you look at his numbers throughout the year and compare them to past years, he is attacking. It's a matter of whether or not he's actually finishing when he gets there. And I feel like people confuse or conflate he needs to attack with he needs to actually finish when he gets to the rim. Doesn't seem like he has a problem getting into the paint and getting to the rim. It's that, you know, he doesn't finish through people anymore. And when he tries to go around them and stuff, he doesn't have quite that same lift. So things will go off the bottom of the rim or a little bit too high or a little bit to the side. And it seems like that finishing versus attacking dichotomy gets a little bit confused.
And I agree with you. And I think it's you talk about going around, you know, kind of that sort of I'm sure we've talked about this before, but kind of that shiftiness kind of like on the takeoff is that bit of athleticism that's just never coming back.
Right.
At this point, in his MVP year, like it was kind of a thing where he'd like be going full speed and jump stop and explode to the basket at like a 75 degree angle to where he was going before. And at this point, you got to figure that there's enough mileage and damage on those joints that's just not happening anymore. You give him a lane to the rim and he can finish. You put a body there and it's tougher for him. And he's never been a guy who's been great at drawing contact in such a way to elicit a foul call, which is a real skill, and that's not something he's ever really excelled at. And
excuse me, hang on a second. The guys that don't draw fouls, it's because the refs hate them and are biased against your favorite team. I'm well aware of this fact from listening to Knicks fans talk about it nonstop.
You're jumping straight into a guy's chest every time, and you're creating the contact, and you from a position of no advantage. So the ref sees it as a verticality play and doesn't blow the whistle.
Yeah, now that sounds like some techno babble nonsense right there, Seth.
Well, that's what I'm here for. So, but if that was, I mean, if you want to talk about a way that you know he could climb back up a level, and that's something that is physically doable for him, probably, whether he could make that adjustment to figure out how to kind of draw guys off balance just that little bit extra to get those foul calls that whether it's Andrew Wiggins or Butler or of course James Harden get, you know, going to the basket. That would be, you know, just a way to bump his efficiency back up to a level where he can start to talk about him as a, you know, above average point guard, a star player type thing. But that's, I don't think that's something that either of us really see as especially likely.
No, I don't necessarily think so either. On the other side of the court, the, you know, not just Isaiah now, but, you know, so a lot of their offense is, you know, sort of those delayed pick and rolls for Isaiah just after the transition period ends. And, you know, one thing that I saw yesterday, and this is something that I talked to him about a couple years ago for a story that I did, or not really a story, like a Q&A type of thing that I did for Grantland. Amir Johnson, when you watch him set those screens, he sets screens a completely different way for Isaiah than he does for, like, Evan Turner or even for Jay Crowder when he gets those screens. You know, he holds it a little bit longer for Turner because he knows that, you know, he needs the space if he wants to take a jumper or get to the rim, whereas for Isaiah, he's got the speed, so Amir doesn't hold it quite as long. He gets out of there so that he forces the defender to make a choice. And then for, you know, for Crowder, he does a little bit different. It's just, you know, watching that guy is so interesting to me. Just such a smart player.
Yeah, he, you know, his probably the ankle issues have probably, you know, taken some of the last bit of effectiveness from him, but or in the top end, but he's, you know, kind of over the last half decade, a little bit more maybe, a guy who has been one of the better players, least appreciated by, you know, most people, just because he's a guy who doesn't put up the big stats.
Right.
And for those, like, those things, the screen setting, the rim protection, the pick and roll defense, the defensive communication, all those, like, you know, those all that you know, what in the pre-sport view era you might have called the intangibles that he shows. Yeah.
There's something to be said for knowing where to be and when, and knowing what to do when you get there. And that's, not a lot of guys know all of that, but he does, and you know, better than a whole lot of people. And that, just doing that as a base level, can make him an effective player, and he does that and more.
Well, especially if you're, you know, 6'10", with right. Long arms, that certainly adds to the effectiveness of being in the right place at the right time, looking in the right direction.
Yes, for sure. Do you have anything else on this first game before we move on to the second one?
I thought Kelly Olynyk looked pretty good. He was, I think, the Boston's most effective offensive player. He had some nice pick and pops, some good spot ups, you know, on ball rotation, and was effective in the post at times. And it seemed like they were so focused on you know, running stuff through Evan Turner and Isaiah. And Jay Crowder took a billion shots, that they went away from him perhaps a little too much.
Yeah, I think he's, you know, him and Amir, I think, are their two best and most effective big men. I think that's sort of become clear throughout the season. But now that you bring him up, that actually raises something that I wanted to talk about that I completely forgot about before I asked that. Our friend Matt Moore, during the game, said on Twitter that Marcus Smart is so good. And then, you know, the first response basically was, he only shoots 32.5%, which, like, okay, fine. Yes, he only shoots 32.5%, but that does not prevent a player from still being good. You know, Matt has talked specifically a lot about how fans at this point now only care about shooting and nothing else. He blames it on the Warriors. I think it was cropping up even a little bit before that with, like, the pace and space and threes, Heat and Spurs teams, but it has sort of exploded over the last year and a half or so with the way that Golden State and Atlanta and some teams have been playing. But you know, the main reason I wanted to bring up that smart thing was because, you know, people just tend to not really understand defense, you know, not just the value of defense, but like what actual good defense is, you know, how players get to be good defenders, why it takes usually a little bit of time before that happens, the fact that defense isn't all effort, and then also especially the fact that, and this is something, you know, you and I have been talking about for a while and have been trying to work on something about, but just the value of pressuring the ball on defense and how that shaves seconds off of the shot clock, which, you know, helps drive down, you know, the other team's offense's efficiency. And all of that is stuff that Smart and then Avery Bradley as well do extremely well. And that's sort of like hidden value that people really just don't have an understanding of yet.
So Marcus Smart is an interesting case for this, just because I actually think that because he's a guy who often makes the spectacular effort defensive play. There's the one a couple days ago where someone was trying to walk the dog against him, and he just dove on it like a, you know, like a live grenade. And it's like, oh, that's a great play. It's like, because he makes those kind of plays, he might actually be a guy who gets overrated defensively, just because you see those great plays when, you know, so much of defense is, you know, the 80% of the time or whatever, your guy doesn't have the ball. And, you know, well, he might get, he can get caught ball watching, get caught over gambling for steals. And not on the ball, he's obviously kind of a terror, but he just, if he's actually as effective overall, all as kind of those highlight plays would represent. And my sense is right now he's a touch overrated, and that, you know, some of those things are fixable. But it's in a way it reinforces your point, because he's doing the things that we're noticing. And so much of good defense is, you know, to get back to Amir Johnson, just being in the right play. So a guy takes, you know, Amir Johnson, you know, effectively snuffs out a drive, not by, you know, this you know, Herculean rotation. It's he's standing in the right spot when the guy starts dribbling. So the guy's like, all right, the lane's not open, let me swing the ball. And that's, you know, that's effective defense. That's you know, you made them burn 4 seconds of the shot clock for something that gave them nothing. And that's for, especially with the naked eye, that's really hard to evaluate.
Right. That's, you know, I needed to get that discussion in there about Marcus Smart, just because.
Yeah, shooting efficiency, overall is kind of, it's to some degree.
Whoa! We don't use Latin here. That's confusing.
Yeah. We both have law degrees here. We can talk like that.
Inter alia, we can talk like that.
That doesn't mean what you think it means.
Yeah, I know.
Post hoc ergo. Anyway, that's enough of that. You may lose my train of thought. So res ipsa locator.
Oh god! All right. We're moving on to the second game now. we're gonna talk now about the Lakers Kings game, the late game. Kings were up by 27 at one point. Lakers stormed all the way back in the fourth quarter, and you know, the period bridging the third and fourth quarter. Almost the entirety of that stretch was played with Kobe on the bench, and somehow still Reggie fucking Miller was crediting Kobe with the comeback. I mean, good lord.
Yeah, I think we've said our piece on that particular.
Yeah, we're not going to talk about that. Let's talk about something else. Yeah. Let's talk about D'Angelo Russell.
Yeah. So seems like he might be starting to figure it out.
It's almost, you know, like if you take a guy who was a point guard in college that excelled with the ball in his hands, making smart passes, taking pull-up jumpers, and you stick him off the ball for the early part of his career and ask him to basically just stand there as a rookie and also jerk around his minutes and call him out in the press and treat him like he's fucking 4 years old, he's not going to be that good. And then when you give him the ball back and give him some minutes, he's going to be better. You know, who would have thought?
Well, putting him in the position where he's comfortable, I mean, it's at this point a pretty huge cliche talking about basketball, but the game slows down for him because he's familiar with what's going on. And so, you know, he's able to, you know, he's not necessarily the quickest, but he's quicker in thought and is able to put him in a situation where he is familiar with what he's seeing. And as he's gotten more familiar with the NBA game, now he's again more familiar with what he's seeing. He can use that kind of speed of thought to get to spots on the floor with you know, trickiness and change of pace and stuff like that. And he's even starting to, at least last night, starting to add a little bit of kind of cleverness to his finishing around the basket, which is
That one drive to his right, the player he got hurt on.
he hurt himself doing it, but yeah,
that's, right. That was, you know, but still, that's, you know, that's a hard drive to his offhand that he finished with his offhand off balance while falling down on a scoop layup oversized. Like, that's a really, really nice play that, you know, as he gets older and better, he should be able to make and not, you know, kill his ankle and fall down.
Yeah, and the book on him, you know, coming in was I'm you know, going off of like draft express type stuff rather than actually having watched him in college, because who watched college? Was that he basically he never used his offhand, and not just rarely, but never used his offhand. I think I remember our friend Nate Duncan doing a podcast, and he did a lot of scouting on him, and basically it remembered about 2 times he tried to finish all last year with his right hand. So if he's adding that now and to some degree comfortable with it, and if he's gonna sprain his ankle trying to do it, how comfortable he is who knows. But
that seems sort of like a little bit of a fluke, but it was good to see him go that way at all.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's something that his teammate Julius Randle can't do yet.
No. And yeah, that's someone who's maybe too comfortable doing what he's familiar with.
Right, and that's something that you brought up on Twitter during the game as well about, you know, his ISOs, and I saw people were getting into you for it. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. There's a play down at the end where, like, there's a couple things about what happened with Julius Randle's game that the first thing is his tendency is he catches the ball in the perimeter and immediately just starts pounding the ball. Really, I think what we've both noticed is his kind of most effective skill is to kind of catch triple threat position, rip through hard 1-2 dribble drive to the basket. That's the best use of his kind of his combination of power and quickness. And he kind of, when he just immediately starts dribbling, he loses that a little bit. And there was probably about 2 minutes left in this game where. I think it was the possession right after Clarkson had turned it over. He kind of makes a slice cut across the top, catches the ball at the arc, starts dribbling, takes about 4 or 5 dribbles, breaks his guy down, dribbles into traffic, and gets called for a charge. The charge itself might have been a bad call, but he's driving into a sea of bodies with no plan at all.
There was nothing good happening there anyway.
Yeah. I mean, maybe they should have called a block and should have shot free throws. But on balance, making like driving in that way is more bad things are going to happen than good. And it's just like I'm driving because I'm driving, and I'm driving all the way to the basket. There's no real chance of like a floater. There's not necessarily looking for a kick. And since I'm going left. Every time it's going to be hard to get all the way to the basket, and then I've got to finish over length, which isn't always a strength for him either.
And the thing is, he can make a pass off the dribble. Like we've seen him do that on occasion, and like he seems to have decent vision when his head is up, but you know, too often it's not, and it's just the one track mind, and that's what trips you up a lot with him.
Yeah, and it's mostly just the way that's you know, classic ball stopping is what's going on there, because it's like, it's catch, dribble, do something, get in it. Whereas, again, if he was catch, pivot, hard jab step drive, or hard jab step, no drive there, swing the ball, like that just is more conducive to good offensive flow. And him being allowed to play this way, I don't think that for his skill set, that is a profitable way to play in a good modern NBA offense. And obviously, he's not playing in a good modern NBA offense, but he's being allowed to like reinforce these bad habits over the year. And like the stuff he's getting kind of called out on isn't actually the stuff that he might need to work on.
Right. Exactly. The other thing with him, early on in the game, late in the first quarter when he came in, they had him trying to guard Boogie in the post. That was not something that was going to work out all that well for him. Julius Randle's a strong kid, but DeMarcus Cousins is a man.
Yeah. Then there was other times, just noticing defensively, there's also a few times where he was guarding Kufis in the post and just offered very little resistance for Kufis.
Right, there was one play, I think, early in the fourth quarter. Kufis sort of flashed into the middle of the lane right in front of him, and he just sort of let him get, 4 or 5 feet from the basket and catch the ball. And then all he had to do was turn around and flip it over his shoulder.
Yep, just
deny that position, that you can't let him catch the ball there at all.
Yeah, no resistance to letting him get just like into the lane for an easy like left shoulder turn jump hook,
right.
Which you let an NBA player get both feet in the paint and get that up over you. That's not a way to play good post defense.
And then down the stretch, the Lakers switched Brandon Bass onto Boogie, and he did a great job. his defense.
Brandon Bass is a professional basketball player.
His defense in the fourth quarter was terrific.
Yeah.
It was he has been serviceable on defense in the past. That might have been the best stretch of defense I've seen from him since he guarded Carmelo in the Knicks-Celtics first round series like 3 years ago.
Yeah, I remember. Didn't he guard Dwight reasonably effectively when they played Orlando? The Celtics played Orlando in a playoff series.
That sounds like something that could have happened, but I don't remember it off the top of my head.
Yeah.
I remember after he did a pretty decent job.
Because Glenn Davis was still playing in the Celtics then, and that was before they traded the two for each other. So never mind, that's incorrect.
Maybe it was KG.
Yeah, anyway.
Anyway. on the Kings side, in this one, Boogie, man.
Yes.
Boogie.
He's really good, and I just one time want to see him, in a good situation. Just both to see how good he can be on a good team, but also, to wonder, like, it's sort of always been my contention, knowing nothing, that he's a guy who a lot of his kind of attitude stuff is misapplied competitiveness that manifests itself in destructive.
I'm glad that you brought that up. I want to bring something up.
Please.
He did a Q&A with Slam Magazine today, and one of the exchanges, I will read it off right now. So this is the question from Slam. They go, it's random, but I see a lot of Kevin Garnett in you, from your leadership style to the way you move. Do you see it? And Boogie says, possibly, but this is what I've come to conclude. Winning covers up everything. If KG was always losing and was the same person, they would think he was the worst guy ever. That's basically the situation I'm in.
And, that's to some extent, he's not wrong, because there's a lot of, whether it's MJ or Kobe or anything like that, a lot of kind of stuff you would see as just being a jerk was like competitive fire on winning teams, and that's how that is how the narrative kind of tends to work. The degree to which it's in you talk to people who cover teams in the area, and they, you know, they talk about generally unpleasant. But again, how much of that is just who he is, and how much is it a crummy, rotten, no good, no fun situation that everyone is sick of each other by now. And it's not like there aren't
DeMarcus Cousins and the terrible, horrible, no good, very bad team.
Yeah, exactly. it's not like there aren't a lot of things you can point to that have gone down, like, over the course of his Kings tenure that would make someone frustrated. And, you know, so, yeah.
Exactly.
So I just, you know, like to see him play for a real team one day.
That would be nice, you know, and, you know, not even necessarily somewhere else. Like, maybe the Kings could become a real team one day.
Okay.
Maybe. Probably not. I'll take him in New York. That'd be nice.
him and KP?
Oh, stop it. You're giving me dreams. There were a few plays in this game where he just, like, I had to shake my head, and, like, you know, in my notes, I'm just like, oh, Boogie's layup at 9:53. Okay, big man. Like, that's all I could write at that point. And it's like, in the second quarter, I was like, there's one other. It's like, Kobe is on fire, but Boogie. Like,
so, you know, I don't watch a lot of football anymore, but the athlete he kind of most reminds me of right now, just in terms of like, what do you do with that, is Gronk. Just because the combination of, like, speed, agility, power, what, like, and you can displaying all of them in kind of at the same time is it's like what do you do with that?
And they wound up in polar opposite organizations.
Right.
Like, the Kings couldn't possibly be any more dysfunctional, and the Patriots couldn't possibly be more, like, impeccably, like, the behavior stuff too. Like, Gronk is, you know, a character. If Boogie was on a team like that, he'd be treated like Gronk.
So Gronk, I mean, there's some difference there in that, like, you know, Gronk is a goofball as opposed to you know,
like,
so
a menace.
Anyway, enough psychoanalyzing of players from, you know, through a television set.
But that's, you know, we both have advanced degrees in television psychoanalysis. That's what we went to law school for, right?
I actually took a, that was my clinic. My second year was advanced TV diagnostic studies. Yeah, no, that wasn't.
Wait, it wasn't? Then why are you on this podcast?
That's a good question. You ask me.
there were also, you know, a few times throughout the game that Boogie would just push the ball up the court by himself, and, you know, either take it all the way, make a pass, blah blah blah. All of a sudden, at one point, Reggie, again, was like, you don't see that from DeMarcus Cousins pushing the ball up the court. That's because of George Carl. Like, did he not watch Boogie, like, ever? I don't know. But there was one play in particular in the third quarter, and then again in the fourth quarter, Boogie pushed it up, kicked it to Rondo on the wing, then came and set a screen for Rondo, and they went into the pick and roll. The first time it got a basket for Quincy Acey in the third quarter, and then the second time was what wound up being basically the game-winning shot with that Rondo Boogie pick and roll in delayed transition. Lou Williams went under the pick and roll for some reason, went over the pick and roll for some reason and gave Rondo a ton of space to drive into the lane. Actually, a great point pointed out by Reggie there on the replay, surprisingly. And Rondo wound up basically with a wide open floater. But it's basically what I'm trying to say is him pushing the ball isn't necessarily just about getting himself a shot right away or getting anybody else a shot right away. It helps them get into their early offense and create sort of that chaos and confusion. So it's I always like to see that.
And the other part of it, this isn't necessarily part of him pushing the ball, but just kind of, I think we might have talked about this before, but maybe not, is, you know, they're doing a lot of really kind of neat merger of old school and new school with Cousins on the break, in that, you know, since he's often the guy who's grabbing the rebound, making the outlet pass, in a traditional secondary break, like the first big down, the floor rim runs, and the wings go to the corners, and the point guard picks a side, and then the guy who made the rebound, like, you know, trails to the arc. Well, that's kind of what they're doing, and that's where, you know, Cousins' three-pointers are coming. Is in that, from that trail spot. And then also if it's not there, then like you said, you get into that kind of that drag screen game, which is super difficult to defend just from a communication standpoint. So I kind of like how they are finding a way to, all right, these three pointers and this perimeter play from our big man is a good thing. How can we're implementing that in kind of a traditional, like, very old school North Carolina, which is George Karl's background, kind of way. So I do like that as a mashup of kind of the modern and the classic.
Oh, definitely. And what you mentioned about that's how he gets his threes, happened in the first quarter. Roy Hibbert just sort of laid off like 6 or 7 feet on one of those. And Boogie was like, all right, you're not going to guard me, I'll just take it. And he made it twice. You got to guard him out there now.
And especially in kind of semi-transition, like as a big man, what's your role in semi-transition? It's to get under the rim. And now you're having to kind of choose, am I going to the rim? Am I stopping at the nail so that I can get out on this trail three-pointer? And then that possibly opens up some other stuff.
Right. Speaking of opening up other stuff, a nice transition there. Nice game from Ben McLemore last night. Only made one of his 5 threes, but 16 points, 4 rebounds. Got out in transition a little bit. I thought he played well.
Yeah, he's a guy who's maybe gotten lost in the shuffle a little bit this year. Still, you don't know if they know what they have with him yet. You talk about guys nearing the end of their rookie contracts that you could maybe, pick up as sort of part of the, quote, second draft. He'd be an interesting guy to look at for some teams.
Over the last month, still very low usage, but shooting 51% from the field and 39% from three over the last month. So
you can do some things with that.
Right. Not taking a lot of shots, 5.5 a game, 2.33s a game, not getting to the free throw line, not shooting well from the free throw line, not doing much else other than shooting, period. But you can use that skill and leverage it in other ways. He's just sort of been squeezed out. Rondo has the ball all the time. Obviously, you want Boogie to have the ball. Rudy Gay is going to soak up possessions, which he's been doing at like a moderately efficient rate for 10 years now. And Omri Caspi, who did not play last night, has been the best 3-point shooter in the league so far. He is sort of
non-Kawhi Leonard division.
Right, sure. But, he is sort of squeezed out of a role there. And then in the second half, they, for some reason, were running Seth Curry out there because they got confused and thought he was Steph or something.
Listening to quotes after the game, that was a defensive move more than anything else. Which, okay, I don't necessarily want to dismiss that just based on the fact that what we've just been talking about earlier about defense being sort of harder to measure. I mean, if George Karl is watching and saying that, of all their kind of two guards, Seth Curry is the one who's competing the best on defense.
Sure.
I mean, given that the other options are like James Anderson and Ben McLemore and Marco Bellinelli, that's not ridiculous on his face.
No.
That Seth Curry could
Although
be,
he did seem to be getting lost a bunch of times in that 8 or 10 minute stretch that he was playing surrounding the third and fourth quarter.
Yeah. I mean, it's... I won't disagree with you there.
Yeah, I mean, but, maybe there's stuff there that we're not necessarily seeing. George Karl has been doing this since before we were born, or at least since before I was born. But you're not that much older than me.
Shots.
You're not much older than me, though.
Yeah. Anyway. What else from this game? I mean, aside from the Kings working really hard to
blow
jack it away. Yeah.
You know, they finally ran the Lakers, that being they, ran, I think, their first Russell Randle pick and roll of the game early in the fourth quarter. I jotted that down in my notes as a question mark. I'm pretty sure it was. That is nonsense. Like, how that doesn't happen early and often every time they get in. I mean, that it just can't not happen before that.
Like, I mean, some of that is, I wonder how effective a pick and roll man Randle is at this point. That doesn't mean you should. That's more reason to do it a lot now, though.
Right. Like, they should be doing that as much as possible, so that by the time those guys are ready to win, they're ready to win. You know, that play needs to become like their version of something that you can't guard.
Because you can see how, you know, Randle could be a guy who, you know, catches the ball in the pocket at the elbow.
Right.
And, you know, what we talked about earlier with his ability to you know, with a live dribble, you know, make a hard play to the basket, or see people in front of him, you know, make the skip pass to the opposite corner for a three, in a modern NBA offense. And so those are, like, you can see the potential for that kind of effectiveness to be there, but you got to work on those skills. Those are learned skills, not just something that you can, all right, now, you know, 2 years, next year we have a different coach, perhaps, and are playing actual NBA basketball. Now go forth and do these things that you've never worked on. And that's something specifically that you would just like to see them, you know, do. Because, you know, they have, you know, some personnel that they can space out around that. And, you know, it's not like we want to see everyone run the sprint pick and roll all the time. But you look at the Lakers personnel and, you know, a lineup with Russell and Randle and Clarkson and, I don't know, maybe Bass and Anthony Brown or something. It's not a world beater of a lineup, but that's certainly a lineup where a sprint pick and roll attack can function, I think.
Yeah, I agree. What did you think, you know, before we check out here, what did you think of Clarkson in this one?
You know, I think it's some degree, and it's understandable given the mess of their team, he's maybe taken a slight step back with the ball in his hands this year. He had so much freedom at the end of last year because of all the injuries they had, that maybe you saw it a little bit, kind of the play down at the end where he just kind of coughed it up under no pressure.
Right.
That was another one
where Reggie called it out beforehand. Like, oh, Clarkson has to be careful with his dribble here. Rondo will try to sneak around you. And then he did exactly that. I mean, he had tried it like three or four possessions in a row and didn't get it. But Clarkson sort of left the ball behind him while he was taking off on that dribble. And Rondo was just like, okay, thanks.
And I think he's another guy who, like you said, has been kind of, you know, what his role is going to be has been difficult. I think a difficult adjustment for him this year, and you know, kind of bouncing between playing with Kobe, playing with Russell. He's not going to have the ball in his hand much in either scenario, and he hasn't shot the ball great this year. So, figuring out if he's going to be, you know, is he like a third guard who plays, you know, alongside either starting guard? Is he going to be your two guard? I don't think at this point, I think it's clear he's not going to be your point guard.
Right.
I mean, that's Russell. Maybe, you know, maybe he...
Sort of like a Bledsoe Knight situation where they're both nominal point, like they're just guards.
Yeah. And I think he's more the Knight in that scenario.
Yes.
That he's, you know, better as a two guard, even if he would prefer to be a point guard.
Right, I agree. You got anything else from this game, man?
Not much. You know, when's our next Lakers Thursday night game?
Next week.
Oh, really?
Yeah. next week we've got Cavs Spurs in the early game. Looking forward to that one. and then Lakers-Warriors in the late game. Three of the four best teams in the league, and Kobe in action. Yeah. So that should be fun. Seth,
there's no way we can somehow swap Oklahoma City in there.
Right, that would be gorgeous. I would love it.
Yeah.
But you know, we don't make the schedule. We just talk about the games. Cavs, Spurs, Lakers, Warriors next week. I'm Jared Dubin. That's Seth Partnow. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm at JADubin5. Seth is at Seth Partnow. You can find all of our podcasts from the HP Basketball Network on hardwoodparoxysm.com or on iTunes by searching for Hardwood Paroxysm Basketball Network or for the name of this podcast, Quo Vadimus. You may notice if you're listening to this podcast that we have a new home. Podcasts are being hosted now by Blog Talk Radio. There's ads at the beginning of and end of this podcast. Apologies for that, but, you know, got to pay the bills. Seth.
I make no apologies for the ads.
Yeah, you know what? No apologies. We're finally able to do this. It's been in the works for a while. And, you know, this will help us bring you more podcast stuff throughout the entire HP Basketball Network. You got all of our podcasts that you can find, you know, like I said, hardwoodparoxysm.com or by searching on iTunes for Hardwood Paroxysm Basketball Network. Seth, thanks a lot for doing this, man. Let's talk next week.
All right. Talk to you then.